A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He flagged a study out of Tel Aviv University that just dropped, and it's got some genuinely alarming numbers in it. The headline finding, even minimal artificial light at night, at intensities equivalent to standard street lighting, disrupts the immune rhythms of wild mammals and leads to a 2.35-fold increase in mortality. This is not about extreme light pollution from stadiums or airports. This is the light leaking through your blinds. Daniel's asking us to dig into what this actually means, how solid the science is, and whether we should all be rethinking our bedroom setups.
Before we go further, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, which feels appropriate for a science-heavy episode, honestly.
We'll see if it gets the biology right. So, where do we even start with this one? The studies in environmental pollution. First author is Hagar Vardi Naim, doctoral student at TAU, supervised by professors Yariv Wein and Noga Krumfeld-Shaw. And the setup is worth describing because it's not your typical lab study.
Right. This is one of the things that makes it unusually persuasive. They didn't just put mice in cages under fluorescent lights in a basement. They built outdoor enclosures at the Tel Aviv University Zoological Garden, the Eye. Meyer-Sagal's garden, and they used two species of spiny mice, the golden spiny mouse and the common spiny mouse, both taken from the Judean desert. Half the enclosures got white, LED illumination at night at street lighting intensity. The control group got natural light only, sun, moon, stars. The animals were in semi-natural conditions, which matters enormously for how we interpret the results.
Why does that matter so much? Because lab mice are already living in an artificial environment. Temperature controlled, no predators, standardized food. You can get results in a lab that don't translate to the real world.
That's exactly what the team stressed in the paper. They specifically said studying animals in conditions close to their natural environment rather than sterile laboratory settings highlights the value of using wild models to understand how the immune system functions in the real world. A lab mouse might have a blunted immune response already from the stress of captivity. These spiny mice were basically living in a desert simulation with natural temperature swings, natural foraging behavior, natural social dynamics. The only variable was the light.
What actually happened to them?
Two things, both significant. First, the immune rhythm got flattened. Let me explain what that means. Mammals, including us, have a 24-hour cycle in immune function. Lymphocyte levels in the blood rise and fall predictably. The body produces more or fewer antibodies depending on the time of day. These oscillations enhance the immune response to pathogens. Vardi Naim's team found a very clear 24-hour lymphocyte rhythm in the control mice, with levels peaking during rest hours between 2 and 4 in the morning, which, by the way, matches the human pattern.
Our immune system is most active while we're asleep, essentially.
During rest, yes. And they found that animals exposed to an antigen during rest hours produced far more antibodies than those exposed during active hours. The timing of vaccination or infection matters. The immune system is primed at certain times of the day and less so at others. This is well established in chronobiology.
The light-exposed mice?
Complete flattening of the daily patterns. Instead of peaks and troughs, they got a flat line. The immune system lost its natural timing. Vardi Naim's quote in the Jerusalem Post piece is striking. She said light pollution changes the natural light. Dark regime disrupts the central clock's synchronization with environmental time and changes these patterns, rendering time almost meaningless. The body can't tell when to mount a defense.
Which brings us to the mortality number. 2.35 times higher risk of death.
This is the part that honestly made me put down my coffee when I read it. Krumfeld-Shaw, the supervising professor, told the Jerusalem Post directly, all the mice that were exposed to ALAN died, all of them. She said they conducted pathology exams and found that their immune systems had stopped working to protect the body.
Out? All of them? Over what time period?
The article doesn't specify the exact timeline, but it says extensive and rapid mortality was observed. The 2.35-fold risk increase is relative to the control group, which suggests not all the control mice died, so we're looking at differential survival. But the exposed group had total mortality. That's not a subtle effect. That's a hard endpoint.
This isn't about mice getting a little sniffly. Their immune systems essentially shut down.
Kronfeld Shore was explicit that this is relevant to all mammals. She said it directly. What we found is relevant to all mammals. The immune system operates on the same circadian principles across mammalian species. The suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus, that's the master clock, is conserved across mammals. Light hits the retina, signals go to the SCN. The SCN coordinates peripheral clocks in every organ, including immune tissues. Disrupt the light signal, you disrupt the whole cascade.
Let me push on something. These were wild desert rodents suddenly living in enclosures. Even the control group was in captivity. Could the stress of relocation have amplified the effect?
That's a fair question, and I'd want to see if they did cortisol measurements or other stress biomarkers. But the control group was under the same captivity conditions, same enclosures, same relocation, same everything except the light. So even if baseline stress was elevated across all animals, the differential effect between the groups is attributable to light. Unless there's an interaction effect where light plus captivity stress is synergistic in a way that captivity stress alone isn't, which is possible, but the study design controls for the straightforward confound.
They used white LED, which is the most common type of lighting used today. This isn't some exotic wavelength. This is what's in streetlights, office buildings, most people's homes.
Kronfeld Shore specifically recommended switching to yellow light and reducing illumination levels. Yellow light has less blue spectrum content, and blue light is what most strongly suppresses melatonin and signals to the SCN that it's daytime. She also said municipalities and public institutions can turn down the lights at night, and that compared to other types of pollution, ALAN is relatively easier to deal with, if there's political will.
Which brings us to the policy side. Israel has no legislation on artificial light at night. Kronfeld Shore was pretty blunt about that.
She said even if there were laws, they'd be difficult to enforce. And she gave a concrete example that I found fascinating. They tried to reduce the light at the Western Wall at night, but the authorities opposed it, claiming security reasons or because people liked it that way. They also consulted for the Jerusalem Biblical Zoo because the Givat Masua neighborhood is being expanded, and the zoo wanted to protect its animals from the increased lighting.
The Western Wall example is interesting because it's a collision of values. You've got a religious site that people want illuminated for safety and aesthetics, and you've got ecological evidence that the illumination is harmful. And the security argument is hard to push back on in Israel specifically. That's not a frivolous concern.
No, it's not. And Kronfeld Shore acknowledged this tension. But she also pointed out that there's light contamination everywhere in Israel, even at Mitzpe Ramon in the Negev, which is recognized as a destination for stargazing and astrotourism. When you can't escape light pollution in the middle of the desert, you've got a widespread problem.
Let's talk about the mechanism a bit more, because the immunology here is worth understanding. What exactly is happening when the immune rhythm flattens?
The immune system isn't just a binary on-off switch. It's a complex, multi-layered defense network with different components active at different times. Vardi Naim described it in the article. Lymphocyte levels rise and fall. Antibody production varies. The body anticipates threats based on time of day. If you're a diurnal animal, you're more likely to encounter pathogens during your active hours, so your immune system allocates resources accordingly. Nocturnal animals have the inverse pattern. The clock lets the immune system be in the right state at the right time.
If the clock can't tell what time it is because there's light at night confusing the signal?
Then the immune system defaults to a kind of constant mediocre readiness instead of cycling between high and low alert. It's like keeping your army at battle stations 24/7. They get exhausted, resources are wasted, and when an actual threat arrives, the response is suboptimal.
Though in this case, it wasn't suboptimal. It was non-existent. The mice died.
That's the part that needs more research. The exact cause of death couldn't be determined, according to the paper. The mortality occurred alongside disruption of immune and hormonal rhythms, so there's a likely connection, but they didn't identify a specific pathogen that killed all the mice. It could be that opportunistic infections that a healthy immune system would handle easily became lethal. It could be a systemic failure where multiple systems broke down simultaneously.
There's also the endocrine angle. You mentioned hormones.
Yes. Vardenheim said chronic exposure to ALAN disrupted the timing of the mice's immune and endocrine systems. The endocrine system is also under circadian control. Cortisol, melatonin, growth hormone, they all have daily rhythms. Cortisol, in particular, is a powerful immune modulator. If your cortisol rhythm is flattened, your immune function will be affected. The study doesn't tease apart cause and effect here, but the systems are deeply intertwined.
What does this mean for humans? Because the researchers were careful to say the findings have implications for all living creatures, including humans, but they didn't do human experiments.
Right, and we should be precise about what we can and can't extrapolate. We know from human studies that shift workers, people whose circadian rhythms are chronically disrupted, have higher rates of certain cancers, metabolic disorders, cardiovascular disease, and impaired immune function. The World Health Organization classified shift work involving circadian disruption as a probable carcinogen back in 2007, so the human evidence for circadian disruption harming health is already substantial.
What's new here is the specific finding that light at night, independent of shift work, independent of sleep disruption, can directly impair immune function through the Koch mechanism.
At intensities that most people would consider trivial. Street lighting is not bright. If you've got a street light outside your bedroom window, even with curtains, you're probably getting more light exposure than these mice got. And Kronfeld-Shore's advice was pretty stark. She said children and adults should sleep in complete darkness, without a nightlight, because illumination that is not moonlight weakens the immune system. She insisted children are not afraid to go to sleep in the dark.
I suspect a lot of parents would push back on that. Nightlights are a huge parenting norm.
They are, and I'm not going to tell parents what to do. But the evidence is accumulating that even dim light during sleep has physiological effects. There was a study from Northwestern a few years back that found sleeping with even moderate light-raised heart rate and blood glucose in healthy adults. The mechanism appears to be that light keeps the sympathetic nervous system activated when it should be in parasympathetic recovery mode.
The phone thing, Kronfeld. Shore specifically mentioned staying away from cellular phones and screens, especially blue light, before bed, which is advice we've all heard, but it's usually framed around sleep quality, not immune function.
The immune angle is relatively underexplored in the public conversation. Everyone knows blue light messes with melatonin and makes it harder to fall asleep. Fewer people know it might also make you more vulnerable to infection. And Kronfeld-Shore's recommendation was practical. If you must use screens, put them in night mode, which filters out blue wavelengths.
Let's talk about the broader ecological implications, because this isn't just about humans and lab mice. The researchers were explicit that this matters for the whole ecosystem.
They connected it to disease transmission. Vardenheim pointed out that animals with weakened immune systems can transmit diseases to humans. If wildlife populations are immunocompromised by light pollution, they become better reservoirs for pathogens. We saw something conceptually similar with bats and white-nose syndrome. When you stress a wildlife population, the knock-on effects for human health can be significant.
There was also a related study mentioned in the article. Ben-Gurion University researchers, headed by Yael Lennart, published word just last month showing that noise pollution disrupts animal behavior, especially birds. So, you've got light pollution and noise pollution, both hitting wildlife simultaneously.
A bird that can't sleep because of noise and can't get proper circadian signals because of light is getting a double hit. Urban ecology is starting to look at these combined stressors, and the picture isn't pretty. Birds in cities sing louder, and at different times, they start breeding earlier. Their stress hormones are elevated. We're fundamentally reshaping the sensory environment that animals evolved in.
The Jerusalem Post article mentioned that Kronfeld-Shore got positive reactions from colleagues in the U.S. and Europe. So this study is landing internationally.
It's the first study in the world to prove the connection between artificial light at night and weakened immunity in mammals. That's a strong claim, and it seems to be holding up to peer review since it's published in Environmental Pollution, which is a reputable journal. The novelty here is the immune focus. Circadian disruption from light has been studied, but mostly for sleep, metabolism, and cancer. The immune system as the endpoint, and mortality as the outcome. That's what makes this paper stand out.
I want to circle back to something Kronfeld-Shore said that I think gets overlooked in environmental discussions. She framed ALAN as relatively easier to deal with compared to other types of pollution. And she's right. If you want to reduce air pollution, you need to overhaul transportation and energy infrastructure. If you want to reduce light pollution, you turn down the lights or change the bulbs.
The technical solutions exist, and they're cheap. Yellow LED streetlights cost about the same as white ones. Motion sensors for public lighting are off-the-shelf technology. Shielded fixtures that direct light downward instead of upward reduce sky glow without reducing visibility. These are not hard engineering problems, they're policy problems.
The policy problem in Israel specifically is that there's no legislation. Kronfeld Shore said Israel hasn't passed any limits on ALAN.
Most countries haven't. France has some of the better regulations. They require non-residential buildings to turn off exterior lights after a certain hour. A few U.S. states have dark sky legislation. But it's patchy, and enforcement is almost non-existent. The lighting industry has also been pushing brighter and cheaper LEDs without much consideration for spectrum or timing. The default assumption is that more light equals more safety, and that assumption is rarely questioned.
Is it even true that more light equals more safety? I've seen conflicting research on that.
The evidence is mixed. Bright, unshielded lights create glare that can actually reduce visibility. There's a criminology literature showing that increased street lighting has modest effects on property crime, but negligible effects on violent crime. And most crime happens during the day anyway. The perception of safety is real. People feel safer in well-lit areas, but the actual risk reduction is smaller than assumed.
Which makes the Western Wall example even more interesting. The authorities opposed reducing light partly because people liked it that way. It's an aesthetic and psychological preference, not a safety necessity.
That's a legitimate consideration. Public spaces should feel welcoming, but we should be honest about the trade-offs. If illuminating the Western Wall at night is contributing to ecological damage and potentially harming human health, we should at least have that conversation openly rather than defaulting to maximum brightness.
Let me ask you something as a retired pediatrician. What would you tell parents who hear about this study and worry about their kids' nightlights?
I'd say the evidence is pointing toward darkness being healthier, but we're talking about relative risk, not imminent danger. If your child needs a nightlight for psychological comfort, a dim red light is going to be less disruptive than a bright white one. Red light doesn't suppress melatonin the way blue light does. You can also use a very low wattage bulb and place it low to the ground out of the child's direct line of sight. The goal is to minimize light hitting the retina during sleep hours. Blackout curtains are probably the single most effective intervention. They're cheap, they work, and they don't require changing your behavior. After that, eliminate light sources in the bedroom. Cover LED. Indicators on electronics. Get an analog alarm clock instead of a glowing digital one. Charge your phone in another room. Kronfeld Shore's advice about sleeping in complete darkness is well supported by the circadian literature.
You know what I find interesting? This study came out of Tel Aviv University's Zoological Garden, which is essentially a research facility embedded in a public space. Maya Segal's garden is open to visitors. So the research is happening in a context where the public can potentially engage with it.
The researchers are doing applied work locally. They advised the Jerusalem Biblical Zoo on protecting animals from the Givat Masua neighborhood expansion. They tried to work with the Western Wall authorities. This isn't ivory tower science. They're trying to translate findings into practice in their own city.
Though the Western Wall pushback suggests translation isn't easy, even when you're local and engaged.
Welcome to environmental policy. The science is often the easy part. Getting institutions to change behavior based on the science is where things stall.
Let's talk about the study's limitations, because no study is perfect, and we should be upfront about what we don't know.
First, sample size. The article doesn't give exact numbers, but rodent studies are typically small. If they had, say, 20 mice per group, that's enough for statistical significance on mortality, but limits how much you can generalize. Second, the mice were taken from the Judean desert to outdoor enclosures in Tel Aviv, which has a different climate. Even though the enclosures simulated natural conditions, the temperature, humidity, and barometric pressure differ from their native habitat. Third, they used white LED at a single intensity. We don't know if the effect is dose-dependent. Would dimmer light have a smaller effect? Is there a threshold below which the immune system copes?
The mechanism isn't fully characterized. We know the immune rhythm flattened and the mice died, But the causal chain between those two observations isn't completely mapped.
The researchers are careful about this. They say the rise in mortality occurred alongside disruption of immune and hormonal rhythms, suggesting a likely connection, but they don't claim to have proven causation. That's appropriate. To prove causation, you'd need to show that specifically rescuing the immune rhythm, perhaps by blocking the light signal pharmacologically or genetically, prevents the mortality. That's a follow-up study.
Another limitation. These were wild rodents, not humans. The researchers say the findings are relevant to all mammals, and the circadian biology is conserved, but the magnitude of the effect might differ across species. Humans might be more resilient, or we might be more vulnerable. We don't know.
We can't do the experiment. You can't randomize humans to total darkness versus streetlight level illumination and then track mortality over years. We have to rely on observational studies. The shift worker literature is the closest we have to a natural experiment, and it does show elevated disease risk. But shift work involves multiple disruptions: sleep deprivation, eating at odd hours, social stress, not just light at night.
Where does this leave us practically? If you're a listener who just heard that streetlights might be weakening your immune system, what do you actually do?
I'd say there are three levels. Level one is personal. Control your sleep environment. Darkness, cool temperature, no screens before bed. These are cheap and have no downside. Level two is community. If your neighborhood is overlit, attend a town council meeting. Ask about shielded fixtures, warmer color temperatures, motion sensors. Most municipalities have never been asked about this and are open to reasonable suggestions. Level 3 is regulatory. Support dark sky legislation and lighting ordinances. This is the slowest lever, but the most impactful at scale.
On the personal level, I'd add, don't panic. The mice were exposed continuously, every night, for what sounds like an extended period. A night here or there with some light leakage probably isn't going to crash your immune system. This is about chronic exposure.
Chronicity is key. The immune disruption built up over time. It's the difference between pulling one all-nighter and working the night shift for years. The body can compensate for acute disruption. Chronic disruption wears down the compensatory mechanisms.
One thing I appreciate about this study is that it doesn't just identify a problem. It proposes solutions. Kronfeld-Shaw gave specific, actionable recommendations. Yellow light, reduced intensity, darkness during sleep, night mode on screens. This isn't one of those papers that concludes with more research is needed and leaves you hanging.
She was refreshingly direct. Turn down the lights, switch to yellow, sleep in the dark, keep phones away from the bed. These are not expensive or complicated interventions.
Though the Western Wall example shows that even simple interventions can run into cultural and institutional resistance, light has symbolic meaning. It's associated with safety, with hoyness, with modernity. Telling people to embrace darkness is asking them to override deep cultural associations.
That's where the communication challenge lies. The environmental movement has sometimes framed light pollution as an aesthetic issue, preserving the night sky for stargazing. That's a valid concern, but it doesn't motivate everyone. Framing it as an immune health issue might reach a different audience. If you tell someone that the streetlight outside their window is potentially weakening their immune system, they might care more than if you tell them it's blocking their view of Orion.
Especially after the past few years, immune health is top of mind for a lot of people.
Vardy Naim explicitly connected it to vaccination. She said the immune system's response to vaccination might be less than optimal if circadian rhythms are disrupted. That's a concrete, relatable concern. If you're getting a flu shot or any vaccine, you want your immune system to be functioning at its best. The timing of the shot matters, and so might the quality of your sleep and light environment in the days before and after.
There's also the zoonotic disease angle. Vardy Naim mentioned that animals with weakened immune systems can transmit diseases to humans. If light pollution is immunocompromising wildlife populations, we're potentially creating new pathways for pathogen spillover.
We're doing it at scale. Satellite data shows that artificial light at night is increasing globally at about 2% per year. The transition to LEDs, which are cheaper to run, has actually accelerated light pollution because people install more lights when the operating cost drops. It's a rebound effect. Efficiency leads to more consumption.
We're making the problem worse, not better, even as the technology improves.
In aggregate, yes. Individual fixtures are more efficient, but total light output is rising, and the spectrum is shifting toward blue-rich white LEDs, which are more biologically disruptive than the warm sodium lights they're replacing. It's a classic case where technological progress doesn't automatically solve an environmental problem. It can exacerbate it if the incentives are wrong.
Let's zoom out for a moment. This study is coming out of Israel, which has a strong tradition of chronobiology research. Is there something about the Israeli academic ecosystem that's particularly good for this kind of work?
Israel has invested heavily in life sciences and the universities. TAU, Hebrew University, Weizmann, Ben-Gurion, all have strong biology programs. Chronobiology specifically has been a strength. The spiny mouse is a local species, so there's a natural advantage in studying it. And the desert environment provides a sharp natural light dark cycle that makes experimental control easier. You're not dealing with the constant cloud cover and diffuse light of northern Europe.
The researchers also benefit from having the zoological garden as a research facility. Not every university has a semi-natural outdoor enclosure where you can run controlled experiments on wild mammals.
That's an underappreciated research asset. Most immunology is done in specific pathogen-free lab facilities with inbred mouse strains. Those studies are valuable for understanding mechanisms, but they don't tell you much about how the immune system functions in the messy, variable conditions of the real world. The Tauen team explicitly made this point. Studying animals in natural conditions gives you different, and in some ways more relevant, results.
Inbred lab mice also have reduced genetic diversity, which can mask effects that would appear in wild populations. A wild spiny mouse population has the genetic variation that real populations have, so if an effect shows up across that variation, it's more likely to be robust.
They use two species with different activity patterns. The golden spiny mouse is diurnal. The common spiny mouse is nocturnal. That's a clever design choice. If light at night affects both species similarly, despite their different circadian niches, that strengthens the case that the mechanism is fundamental to mammalian biology, rather than specific to one activity pattern.
Did they report any difference between the two species?
The article doesn't break it down by species. The mortality finding, all the exposed mice died, seems to apply across both. But I'd want to see the full paper to know if there were subtle differences in the immune rhythm disruption between the diurnal and nocturnal species. That would be interesting from a mechanistic perspective.
What's the next step for this research program? What questions remain open?
Dose response. What's the threshold intensity below which immune function is preserved? Spectrum. Are yellow LEDs actually safer or just less bad? Duration. Does the effect accumulate linearly, or is there a tipping point? Reversibility. If you remove the light, does the immune rhythm recover, and how fast? Mechanism. What's the molecular pathway from retinal light detection to immune cell function? Is it mediated by melatonin, by sympathetic nervous system activity, by glucocorticoids, or some combination?
The big one. Does this translate to humans, and if so, what's the magnitude?
That's the hardest question to answer. We can't do the experiment, but we can look at natural variation. People who live in dark rural areas versus light-polluted urban areas matched for other variables. Epidemiologically, that's feasible. You'd need a large cohort, good light exposure data, and long follow-up. Wearable light sensors are getting better and cheaper. I could imagine a study where tens of thousands of people wear light loggers and we track immune-related health outcomes over years.
Until then, we've got a strong signal from a well-designed animal study, and it aligns with what we know from shift work epidemiology and circadian biology. The precautionary principle suggests we should take it seriously.
Especially because the interventions are cheap and have no downside. There's no trade-off here. Sleeping in the dark doesn't cost anything. Switching to warmer streetlights doesn't compromise safety. Reducing unnecessary illumination saves energy and money. The only barrier is awareness and institutional inertia.
The cultural attachment to bright light is inherently good. That's not a small barrier.
No, but it's not insurmountable either. Smoking used to be culturally normative. Seatbelts were optional. Environmental norms shift when the evidence accumulates and the messaging is clear. This study is one more brick in that wall.
One last thing before we wrap. I want to note the date on this. The article is from today, May 9th, so this is breaking science news. Our listeners are hearing about this essentially as it hits the press.
Which is fun, Usually by the time we discuss a study, it's been percolating for months. This one is fresh out of environmental pollution, and the Jerusalem Post coverage is hot off the digital press. Judy Siegel-Itzkovich wrote the piece, and she did a thorough job, direct quotes from the researchers, context from the Ben-Gurion noise study, policy discussion. Good science journalism.
It's an Israeli study covered by an Israeli paper, which gives it a local angle that our Jerusalem-based listeners might appreciate. The Western Wall detail, the Biblical Zoo consultation, the Mitzpeh Ramon light contamination. These are specific, grounded examples that make the research feel concrete rather than abstract.
Light contamination at Mitzpeh Ramon is ironic. It's the premier stargazing destination in Israel, and even there you can't escape artificial light. If you can't find dark skies in the middle of the Negev, where can you find them?
Nowhere in Israel, apparently, which is Kronfeldshaw's point.
All right, I think we've covered this from enough angles. The study is solid, the implications are significant, and the practical takeaways are straightforward. Darkness is not something to be afraid of, it's something to seek out.
Which is a nice full circle moment, because the article opens with that exact line, "Don't be afraid of the dark. Turns out the dark is looking out for you."
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The fastest katabatic wind ever recorded was measured in 1812 at the base of the Wilhelmina Mountains in Suriname, where cold air rushing downslope reached an estimated 193 miles per hour before the anemometer disintegrated.
I have so many questions, none of which I'm going to ask.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps new listeners find the show. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop, and we're back soon with more.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.